Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two for today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Yiannis Varoufakis. Yiannis has been a frequent guest in his show in recent months to talk about the economic crisis in his home country, Greece, and in the broader Eurozone. And at the bottom of the hour, Ramsey Kanin, a founder of AK Press and then PM Press, will talk about anarchism in theory and practice. No time for any words in the news, since these are long interviews. So write to Yiannis Varoufakis. Yiannis, a professor of economics at the University of Athens, has been on the show many times since I first had him on in December 2008 to talk about rioting in Greece. Since then, he's been talking mostly about the economic crisis in his country and the crisis in the broader Eurozone. He was in New York this past week, so I finally got to meet him in person. Apologies for the background noise. We recorded this in a Manhattan hotel room, and not even six stories and thick glass are enough to seal out the city sounds. To define a few terms used in this interview, a haircut on Greek debt means that bondholders would be forced to accept losses on the principal, maybe 20% or more, in hopes of making the remaining balance more tenable and of preventing 100% loss through default. These are standard arrangements when corporations run into trouble, but it seems impossible to transfer this routine practice from the private to the public sector. The EU authorities are trying to make these haircuts voluntary. They want the bondholders to accept the loss of principal freely rather than having it imposed on them, because an involuntary arrangement would legally constitute default. An involuntary default would then trigger CDSs, credit default swaps. They're essentially insurance policies against default. These instruments are issued by private banks and insurers, but they'd have a very hard time actually coming up with the money to make good on those promises. But as Yiannis says in the interview, the EU proposes to add a whole new layer of credit default swaps on their own. Insurance policies of the European governments would themselves find it impossible to pay. Okay, Yiannis Varoufakis. Well, it's good to meet you finally, Yiannis, after all these interviews on the phone.
It's delightful.
Welcome to New York. Now, this crisis really was almost inevitable, given the design of the euro, wasn't it? I mean, the thing was just cracked from the start.
Absolutely, because the euro was never designed to sustain the shock waves of a global financial crisis. It was like a building that was predicated upon the assumption that earthquakes don't happen in an earthquake zone.
So let's talk about the fundamental flaws that in the architecture of the euro to start with that now are visible for all to see. But what are the underlying instabilities in the thing?
There are two main causes of trouble in the eurozone. The first one has to do with the fact that we have locked our exchange rates together into a common currency across economies which do not have any other institutional means by which to make amends for evolving and accelerating imbalances within the Union. So every Union, whether it's the United States of America, Britain, Germany before the Euro, requires some mechanism by which to take account of the fact that every such Union, every country, every bloc, will always have deficit and surplus regions. And there must be some mechanism, the markets will not do that, of shifting the surpluses to the deficit region so that the surpluses can be maintained. And Europe never had that.
And that reflects differing levels of productivity, right?
Indeed, the differing levels of productivity are a repercussion, a reflection on the changes in those imbalances and the fact that the surpluses and the deficits are building up simultaneously. So, for instance, let me put it very simply. Germany has higher productivity because it has a lot more. It is more technologically advanced when it comes to manufacturing. This difference with Italy, with Spain, with Greece ensures that Germany accumulates capital a lot faster. That accumulation of capital results in an even more pronounced difference in productivity, and the whole thing spins out of control unless there is a mechanism for taking surpluses from where they're being produced to invest them productively in the deficit regions so that the deficit regions can catch up in terms of competitiveness and productivity. In the United States of America, that happens because there are a number of recycling mechanisms, and one of them, of course, is the military-industrial complex. In Europe, we don't have an equivalent to that. So this is one of the reasons. This is why the tectonic plates were shifting within the Eurozone, and eventually an earthquake would happen within the Eurozone. The second problem, which is just as large in scale and magnitude and importance, has to do with the incapacity of the Eurozone to sustain shocks that come from outside the Eurozone, like the 2008 collapse of the financial sector in the United States. There we have the problem of what I call perfectly separable public debts. So Spain has its own debt, France has its own debt, and yet all these countries are bound by the same currency. And this is a huge problem, because the moment...
The currency that's essentially issued in Frankfurt.
Exactly. This, it's like these countries have a foreign currency, a currency which is issued by another power. And why is this a problem? This is not a moral issue. It's a practical issue. Because let's say that you are PIMCO, or a major investor in the bonds of Spain. And suddenly you start becoming edgy about the prospects of Europe, and you decide to sell your bonds, your Spanish bonds. Now, there are no shock absorbers within Spain to ameliorate for that shock. The reason is, you sell your Spanish bonds, you take euros in return, then you shift those euros to Germany, and you buy German bonds. The Spanish public sector has just received a hit, and there is nothing, no shock absorption mechanism there, nothing to help Spain recover slightly from that hit. If it had its own currency, would have devalued, because all this money would have left the country. Or alternatively, the investor in Spanish bonds would have taken the money out of the public sector by selling the bonds, and would have invested it in the private sector of Spain. So one way or the other, there would have been some kind of shock absorption. But the fact that Germany and Spain share the same currency, and the money that the investor gets from selling Spanish bonds is shifted to Germany, means that we have the beginnings of a run on Spanish bonds. And that once it starts, there is no backstop. There is nothing to stop it. Spain is doomed. And once Spain is doomed, then next door Italy is doomed. It is an architecture that was never designed to take a run on the bonds of one of the member states. And that run on the bonds of one of the member states was going to happen at some point if there was an external shock like the Wall Street collapse of 2008.
When the crisis broke out, it was initially in some of the smaller countries on the periphery. Greece, people say, Greece, small economy, why should it cause so much trouble? Ireland, relatively small economy. Iceland, extremely small economy. Now it's starting to spread to the bigger ones. Italy is not by any measure a small economy. Spain, not as big as Italy, but fairly sizable. Is this the point of no return now, where it's just all going to come tumbling down?
It looks that way. Let me say that the crisis began not with Greece. The crisis began when contagion shifted from Wall Street and the City of London to the banking sector of Europe. The banking sector of Europe became insolvent in 2008-2009. It is a fact that European leaders and bureaucrats never acknowledged. It is where, if you want, the bushfires started. Once the banks were more or less insolvent and kept on a drip feed by the Central Bank of Europe, the ECB, it was then that the credit rating agencies started looking at the repercussions of this reality in the banking sector on sovereigns, on public debt. And it was only after Dubai fell that they realized that one or more of public debts were going to be stressed as a result of what was happening in the banking sector of Europe, and then they focused on Greece. And then the domino effect. It was inevitable it was going to happen, and now we've reached the stage that because the European Union has been in denial all this time that this is a systemic crisis, and has been trying to deal with the Greek case, the Spanish case, the Portuguese case as separate problems, independently of what was happening to the Eurozone as a system, now the big ones are popping, and they are too big to fail and too big to save. So there is a very good chance that even though the Eurozone could have gotten its act together and prevented this popcorn effect from destroying the euro, it hasn't done so. It has continued to remain in denial. It has continued to deal with bankruptcy problems as illiquidity problems. And now we have reached the stage where perhaps, as you say, we're beyond the point of no return.
Yeah, we're recording this on Thursday. The Italian bond market had a good day. I think yields went below 7% for the first time in a few days. But is it possible for the European Central Bank to move in and save Italy's budget, or is it
is the Italian bond market just so structurally doomed that there's nothing that the central bank could do?
It's got nothing to do with the reality on the ground in the Italian economy, or the Spanish economy, or for that matter, initially in the Greek economy. It's what I was trying to explain before, that in a currency union, where you only have monetary union, but public debts are utterly and completely separable, each has his or her own debt, Italy its own, Germany its own, France its own. Once a run on the bonds of a country begins, it will not end. And that is independent of what's happening in the real economy of that country. It's in the nature of the beast. But once it starts unraveling, then it will carry on unraveling until and unless there is some intervention at the systemic level. There's nothing that at the moment that the European Union can do, or the ECB for that matter, to save Italy. There is a lot that they can do to save the Eurozone. In other words, if they're going to introduce any measures for ending this run on bonds in Italy, in Spain, in Portugal, and so on, it has to happen in every single Eurozone member country at once. In other words, to treat the systemic crisis as a systemic crisis. The ECB could be the first port of call in doing this. It could, for instance, monetize a significant part of the debt of each Eurozone member country to stabilize the bond market. At the moment, what it has done, it has tried to act as a foolish firefighter, trying to extinguish a few of the flames in Italy without dealing with flames that are already beginning to leak the public debt of Belgium, of France, and so on.
The European Central Bank, unfortunately, now has a head, an Italian head, and he cannot appear too indulgent, can he? He has to be more German than the Germans.
Well, that's always the case. When you have a democratic president who tries to be more Republican than the Republicans, or an Italian who's trying to prove that he's more German than the Germans, or a Republican who's trying to be more monarchist than the king, then this is what you get. And I think, yes, you're right. It is not just a matter of personality. It is true that the passport that Mr. Mario Draghi is carrying is not helpful at the moment. But beyond that, there is a whole mindset in the European Central Bank which simply says that all those events, this chain reaction of events which is leading to the disintegration of the Eurozone, is none of their business, really. So once they are in that mindset, it's pretty catastrophic.
Now, the contrast with the Federal Reserve's behavior is really stark. I mean, the Bernanke has no problem with buying up hundreds of billions of dollars of long treasury bonds and lobbying, somewhat discreetly, but lobbying for fiscal stimulus. We're not seeing anything like that out of the European Central Bank. What accounts for that distinction?
We must never forget the Eurozone was, from the very beginning, intended to be an extension of Germany. The Eurozone is an attempt to create a greater Germany. And what do I mean by that? Germany had a model which it considered to be a major success, and in many ways it was, after the Second World War. It was predicated upon two pillars. The first was a hard currency, which would be guarded ferociously by an independent Bundesbank, Central Bank of Germany, a central bank whose sole purpose would be to keep the Deutschmark strong. That was the first pillar. Then the second pillar concerns growth. If the central bank will not countenance monetary policy for the purposes of assisting with growth during periods of substandard demand, where do you get the growth from? The answer that the German model had was through aggressive exporting. During a period when the United States of America, either through its own recycling of its own surpluses during the Bretton Woods era, or through its deficit expansion after in the 1970s, which was a major contributor to aggregate demand for Germany, for Japan, later for China, the United States of America was effectively guaranteeing Germany the demand that was necessary in order to keep itself as a net exporter and therefore an importer of demand into Germany. That was a model that the Germans were extremely jealous of and determined to extend into an infinite future. The Eurozone was a social contract between them, primarily with France. And what was the contract about? Germany was very much interested in stabilizing the exchange rate between itself, France, Italy, and Spain, and Portugal, let's say. Why? Because when Volkswagen was building gearboxes for their cars in Portugal, they didn't have to worry about exchange rate fluctuations with the Italian currency, because they wanted to be able to predict what those gearboxes would cost them once they bolted them onto their Volkswagens built in Germany. Similarly, they hated with a passion the devaluation of the Italian lira, because all of a sudden little Fiat cars were becoming competitive vis-a-vis Volkswagens. So they were very interested in a common currency for those reasons. The Eurozone was a major importer of German goods and manufacturer of components of the industrial machinery of Germany. This was a strategic vision of Germany. Now, Germany was very worried that any such extension of the Deutschmark area to the rest of what has become the Eurozone would jeopardize the policy of a hard currency, one that is not ever going to be put in jeopardy by fiscal policy, stimulus packages and so on and so forth, especially by the profligate south of Europe. So their deal was, if you want the Deutschmark, that was what they said to the Italians, to the French and so on and so forth, then you will have to accept that the Bundesbank model goes, and it will simply be exported to the rest of the Eurozone. So we were going to create a new Deutschmark, we'll call it the Euro. It will also be stationed in Frankfurt. It's not a coincidence that the ECB is next to the Bundesbank in Frankfurt. And what went for the Bundesbank will go for the ECB. That was the contract. In the sense, the Germans were honest from the beginning. If you want us to extend our Deutschmark to your countries, this is a deal that you will have to accept.
I'm speaking with Yanis Varoufakis, a professor at the University of Athens. But Germany has Mercedes-Benz and the world's snazziest machine tools.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of Europe doesn't have those things. I mean, so the productive sector of the rest of Europe really is not much of a match for the German competition. So, but didn't anyone think of that from the outset?
Not really. Not really, because you see, the elites in France, in Italy, in Greece, had other priorities. For instance, the French elite, since the 19th century, had one aim in mind, how to squash the working class movement of France, the trade unions movement, by means of some alliance with Prussia, initially Germany later, that would allow the French elite to extend monetary policy, German monetary policy into France, and therefore to effectively pull the rug from under the feet of the trade unions movement. The Italian and the Greek and the Spanish elites were far more interested in not having to worry about devaluation, and therefore inflation, and therefore the prospect of losing part of their wealth, locally produced wealth, when measured in terms of international hard currencies.
They like having their assets in a stable currency.
Exactly. And there was an element of wishful thinking involved, that if you lock these economies together in the context of a monetary union, then everybody will become a little Germany. And as we all know from our personal experiences, wishful thinking can go a long way to explain what we do.
Well, when the euro was conceived, Timothy Garton Ash said this is a hair-raising adventure in political union through money. The political side was very underdeveloped. There's no common political authority. And watching the European elites try to cope with this crisis is quite extraordinary. They just don't have either the understanding or the institutions to deal with it. I thought initially that the crisis might lead to some sort of development of those institutions and the consciousness that might go with it, but it hasn't yet. Is this now a hopeless case?
At the very beginning, in the early 1990s, when the Eurozone was being designed by people like Mitterrand and Kohl, President Mitterrand of France and Helmut Kohl, the Chancellor of Germany at the time, I have no doubt that those leaders and their advisors were hoping, as you said, that monetary union is the first step. And just like in the United States, crisis led to the creation of new institutions like the Fed, for instance, and then later the US Treasury bills, in the response to the crisis, in order to keep the whole thing together. Once you've created it, the whole thing would evolve into more of a political union, and institutions would become richer and more advanced. This is what I think that Mitterrand and Kohl hoped for back in the early 90s. Unfortunately, I think the collapse of the financial sector in 2008 gave rise to an insolvent banking sector in Europe, and what I call a new regime emerged, which I call bankruptocracy, ruled by bankrupt banks, not bankocracy, bankruptocracy. And it was the will, the iron will, of the bankrupt bankers to ensure that they preserved for themselves control of their banks, while the ECB provided the liquidity by which to keep them in a zombified, nevertheless undead state that created all the impediments and constraints within which our leadership now in Europe is finding it impossible to respect those constraints and at the same time save the euro. A prerequisite for saving the euro today is a leadership that is prepared to recapitalize the banks aggressively, effectively, not nationalize them, but Europeanize them. Turn them into public European banks, at least for a period of time before doing what they did in Sweden, which is to resell them. Now, the tragedy is that our European leaders, politicians, have such a cozy relationship at the national state level with the bankers of their own countries that they are not prepared to do that. And it's much easier to focus on the public debt of Greece or of Italy than to discuss the insolvency of the banking sector. And I'm very much afraid that the terrible architecture of the euro has not been allowed to evolve in response to the crisis because of that relationship, that intimacy between nation-state politicians and supposedly national banks, which of course operate as transnational banks.
We need a little more state autonomy. Well, let's talk a little bit, we're just running low on time, but let's talk a bit about your country. Greece now has a new prime minister, former central banker. Italy is likely to get a new prime minister once that clown Berlusconi leaves, and he's likely to be some old Eurocrat. Can rule by technocrats save the southern portion of Europe?
Definitely not. Firstly, it really doesn't matter who is at the helm, who is driving a train which is in an advanced state of derailment. Once the first carriages have left the tracks, it really doesn't matter. God himself could be driving. The derailment will continue.
Well, maybe God can do it.
Well, yes, let's not be blasphemous here. So it really doesn't matter. But then beyond that, there is a delicious irony in who has been given the role of saving Greece at the moment. And Italy. Mario Monti in Italy and Lukas Papadimos in Greece. Let me concentrate on Lukas Papadimos, who happens to be a professor in my department too, so I have a little bit more authority speaking about him. He is a standard neoclassical economist. Actually, he was a student of Ando Modigliani, with whom he co-authored a couple of papers, and then he left academia effectively, even though he keeps his chair at the university, in order to become an apparatchik. He became governor of the Central Bank of Greece, and once he towed the line of the ECB, exactly along the lines of what we discussed earlier, turning the ECB into a glorified Bundesbank, he managed to climb to the top. He became a vice president. But the interesting thing is that for the last 2 years, Lukas Papadimos and people like myself have been arguing against one another. He always countered my argument that Greece was insolvent and had to default 2 years ago, because any delay in defaulting 2 years ago simply makes the bankruptcy problem much, much worse and much more toxic now. And he was a person who was fighting tooth and nail up until 2 weeks ago against haircuts of the Greek debt. So the delicious irony is that now he's a prime minister whose job is to manage a very deep haircut of the Greek debt.
Without triggering default clauses.
Indeed. And think of the inanity of this. They have enforced upon the bankers this 50% haircut by effectively threatening them with a 100% haircut unless they accept that the 50% loss is voluntary, in order to stop the CDSs from triggering, while at the same time turning the European bailout fund, the FSF, into a CDS provider, because this is how they are proposing to deal with Italian debt. Because they don't have enough money to lend to Italy, what they are proposing to do is to insure investors who will be purchasing Italian bonds in case there is a haircut on Italian debt. So effectively issuing CDS.
But these are promises they couldn't possibly make good on.
Well, but this is the plan for dealing with the Italian debt. So if you take it on face value, this is what they are saying. They are saying, for the investors who have bought Greek bonds and also bought CDSs in order to insure themselves, we're going to ensure that those CDSs will not trigger, they will not get, they will have to suffer a haircut, and the insurance policies that they have taken out on that will be null and void. But we will issue new such insurance policies for the new issues of Italian debt, which we guarantee. What kind of credibility is there in this? Zero. This is why the Italian debt is going through the roof in terms of interest rates and spreads, and this is why the Eurozone is on its last legs.
Well, finally, when we spoke a couple of months ago, you said that, well, you had opposed Greece's initial entry into the Eurozone, that leaving the Euro at this point would be disastrous. Do you still feel that way?
I still do. As long as the Euro remains its legal tender in the rest of Europe, we have to remember that in Greece at the moment, people have euros in their pockets. There are old ladies taking their savings out of the bank, and they're keeping them in euros in their refrigerators, in their freezers. Now, the moment Greece leaves the euro and the ATMs start churning out new drachmas, an almighty black economy is going to emerge, because anybody who gets their hands on these new drachmas, because their salaries will be paid in drachmas, will try to swap them instantly for euros, anticipating correctly that in the next hour their drachmas will be worth less in terms of euros. So with the Greek economy replete with euros, because it is the currency of the country, and all ladies having euros in their fridges, all economic activity is going to cease, and Greeks will be trying to swap their new drachmas for euros.
Are people stashing assets in euro-denominated accounts outside of Greece?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So,
what's left in the Greek banks?
Not much. Not much, but salaries will be paid in euros. And to the extent that your salary comes through a bank account, when the ATM starts churning out drachmas, then everybody's going to be trying to swap the flow of their income with the stock of savings, which will be in euros. So that will mean that the Greek economy is not going to be like in Argentina, where you broke the peg, but people had pesos in their pockets and in their fridges or whatever it is that they stack their savings. They will have euros. So we're going to go back to not where Argentina was after the default and the collapse of the peg, but we're going to go back to where Turkey was in the 1980s and 90s, where you had a dual economy. The better off were dealing in French francs and Deutschmark and dollars, and it was only the working class and the lumpen proletariat who was dealing in Turkish liras. There's a precedent in Greece too, in the 1940s, during the Nazi occupation, when you had in the role that the euro plays today, you had the gold sovereign coins, and in the role that the Greek drachma will play, you had Greek drachmas issued by the Nazi authorities at the time. So, in any case, we don't have to get out of the euro. What we need to do is default within the euro, and then watch the euro collapse. And then we can have our own currency, because everybody will simply move out of the euro, because the euro would no longer be in existence. So from a national point of view, and a national interest point of view, it is senseless voluntarily to exit the euro at the moment.
That was Yanis Varoufakis, a professor of economics at the University of Athens. He is one of three authors of a fine new textbook, Modern Political Economics, Making Sense of the Post-2008 World, published by Routledge. It's very expensive, so ask your library to pick up a copy. It's worth it. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was a bit of General Strike, the 1981 hit from DOA, a good setup for this.
Anarchism is all over Occupy Wall Street, its comrade movements all over. I'm not an anarchist, so I thought this would be a good time to talk to someone who was, someone who knows a lot about the theory and practice of anarchism. Ramsey is just that. He founded AK Press at the age of 13 and was a co-founder of PM Press 4 years ago in his full adulthood. He has also contributed to KPFA's Against the Grain. Ramsey Kanan. Welcome, Ramsey. First, just a little about your background. You were a rather precocious fellow starting an anarchist publishing house when you were 13, right?
I did. It was a bedroom effort, and of course I blame my parents.
And were you drawn to anarchism from an early age, too?
I was, and again, given the lack of politics in my parents and of my school chums and associates, I was probably the only kind of overtly political one, and also certainly the only anarchist. So I'm not quite sure how I came to anarchism, to be honest, but by the age of 13, I discovered both anarchism and punk rock, and had a fairly nuanced view of what anarchism was.
Yeah, I want to get to the more high-minded stuff in a moment, but let's talk for a second about the politics of punk, because there's some, you know, there's certainly a lot of anarchism in it, but there's also a lot of crypto-fascism in it. How do you make out the politics of punk?
Well, I mean, punk has one of the blessings of punk has always been that punk was, especially in its early days, was a very broad church. It was definitely the band Crass, who formed in 1977, who made the kind of anarchy of the Sex Pistols more explicit. I was part of that wave of what became known as crass punk or anarcho-punk. Looking back on it, I think basically their ideas were what today we'd probably call kind of militant liberalism. They were very much into single issues. They were into, you know, the campaign for nuclear disarmament, ban the bomb, anti-nukes. They were very much into the peace movement in its broadest sense. They were into what was called do-it-yourself, which is a bit of a misnomer because, of course, doing it yourself actually did mean, to its credit, doing it in concert with others. And, as I say, the politics of Crass as expressed in their numerous handouts, flyers, lyric sheets, the covers of their records, which were big fold-out posters, were muddy and confused, to say the least. They explicitly eschewed any class analysis, and they had a very kind of ahistorical view of anarchism. It was about personal rebellion, and they had no contact with the kind of anarchist movement at the time, which they kind of collided with rather abrasively, though there was some sort of head-scratching and collaboration that went on. But it was definitely a mixed bag, for sure.
And when did you come over to the U.S.?
I first visited the U.S. in 1989. I was a member of a punk rock band called Political Asylum, and we did an American tour. And in 1989, the so-called Continental Anarchist Gathering was in San Francisco. So being kind of moderately popular punk rock stars in the underground, we arranged a kind of three-week American tour, which ended up in the Bay Area. I thought Americans were pretty weird, but I was very taken by the food and the weather in California, I have to say.
What's weird about us?
One of the striking differences, which perhaps we'll get into in a minute, between culture and politics in general in Britain and in America, is that in Britain, whether implicitly or explicitly, people are very aware of class. In America, people are not only not so aware of class, but it's kind of deliberately played down. You know, American workers are all middle class. In Britain, because Britain is still very kind of class conscious, and despite the best efforts of Margaret Thatcher, again, the biggest insult you could call someone politically in Britain would be to call them middle class, coming from the left. So there's still that kind of class consciousness. Also, I think perhaps being a particularly kind of rain-soaked, windswept, doer nation, the Brits have a very good self-depreciating sense of humour, which seems to be sadly lacking in many of my American compatriots.
What differences do you see here between American anarchists and the anarchism you were familiar with in Britain?
It's a tricky question, partly because I was actively involved and familiar, of course, with anarchism in the UK, in Scotland, obviously, in particular. So it's difficult to make a direct comparison. And certainly many of the problems as I would perceive them in America, we were struggling with during the 80s in the UK. The UK has been not only the birthplace of much of great music, but also of many of the ideas, and also that's the case in Europe, which kind of then in many ways kind of influenced contemporary American anarchism. So we were going through similar struggles in the 80s in the UK, which I think were then transported kind of a decade later, partly inspirationally and partly for the worse over to North America. So, for example, when I was in the UK organizing in the 80s and early 90s, there was already moves to call ourselves class struggle anarchists. And we chose those terms deliberately to distance ourselves from other forms of anarchists self-described who didn't see kind of class as the primary, though not all-consuming, but as the primary way of both analyzing the society we lived in and then hence, you know, trying to act accordingly. So there was other strains and variants of anarchism in the UK. UK was the birthplace, of course, of animal rights. So again, their primary focus was obviously not class. So I say there was these different ways to both reorient ourselves in a way that made sense and gave us the better tools for not only analysing society we lived in and making change, but also to differentiate ourselves from what was, if not the majority view of anarchism, was certainly a popular view, and of course a view that the media very much picks up on.
Here I see a certain cross-pollination or similarity or blurry lines of distinction between anarchists and libertarians. Libertarianism has a big influence in American fringe politics, and I certainly see some of that around the Occupy movement, around the Occupy Wall Street movement. Is there anything like that in Britain?
Very little, and the terms actually libertarian have very different meanings in Europe and in North America. The traditional use of the term libertarian, it was typically applied to being a libertarian socialist or libertarian communist, and those were fairly interchangeable with anarchism. You know, the Spanish anarchists, who were the most numerous and perhaps the most thoroughgoing in terms of the Spanish Revolution that certainly we've seen to date in history, they use the term libertarian socialist, libertarian communist interchangeably with anarchist. The North American variant, you know, comes from this bizarre individualist anarchist tradition. It definitely does have its, in the 19th century, it did have its American followers and proponents, most notably Benjamin Tucker. And they, as well as being against capitalism and the state, they emphasize the rights of the individual and that society should not be organized along communist lines. So speak communism with a small c, but their idea was that free individuals would make contracts on a variety of levels and ways with each other. And this, of course, has fed into the kind of current right-wing, anti-state, very pro-capitalist idea of what is now called popular libertarianism here.
You said in the poll tax struggle in Britain, you developed a taste for a kind of vanguardism. Could you tell us that story?
Well, I'm not sure if I developed a taste for it, but that was my conclusion. And again, it's partly a semantic argument or argument over definitions of what is a vanguard. So very, very, very briefly, the poll tax was a universal tax in Britain, which was a property tax. It was universal in that, like property taxes here, heretofore local governments, local areas, part of the raising their local funds came from a local property tax. That tax was only paid by people, hence, that owned property. This was replaced. This was the kind of the jewel in the crown of neoliberal legislation introduced by Margaret Thatcher. And having crushed successfully organized labor, particularly the miners, in 1984-85, they felt that the final plank in this kind of wealth redistribution upwards was to introduce this tax. As I say, the difference with this tax was that it replaced a property tax with those that owned property with a flat rate tax on every adult in the UK. The only people that didn't have to pay the tax were those incarcerated and the Queen of England. So this was a horribly regressive tax in economic terms. The tax was defeated by a massive campaign of civil disobedience. The tax was defeated by the anti-poll tax movement, so-called, encouraging and enabling people not to pay the tax. This was, of course, breaking the law. 50% of the adults in the UK i.e. 17 to 18 million people, never ever pay the tax, which must make it, I don't know, by any standards, one of the biggest mass movements ever in modern history. You had 50% of the population of the UK broke the law continuously. The campaign lasted for 5 or 6 years. The anti-poll tax campaign was very much organised by us anarchists. I was involved in a small anarchist group called Community Resistance in Edinburgh, where I lived. And when the poll tax was first mooted, us Edinburgh anarchists decided that this was the big one, and we'd previously been involved in a variety of, you know, we'd kind of come out of the miners' strike and other largely labour strike support struggles. We did a bunch of anti-apartheid, anti-racist work, etc. This is in the 80s. And then in the late 80s, when the poll tax was first mooted, we decided that this was the big one. And we dissolved our anarchist group in Edinburgh, Community Resistance, and thought that we were going to concentrate organising in our communities, i.e. we divided up Edinburgh into 10 areas where we lived variously, and we would devote all of our energies into the anti-poll tax movement and defeating this tax. We were very prescient and correct. This was the big one. This was, the kind of jewel in the crown of Thatcherite legislation. We were entirely successful in that we defeated the tax, and as a result, Margaret Thatcher was toppled by an internal coup in the Conservative Party. I should also say that because the anti-poll tax movement was predicated on breaking the law, it had no mainstream or official support whatsoever, meaning the Labour Party, the main opposition party in the UK, did not support the anti-poll tax movement. Neither did the trade unions, which of course are tied to the Labour Party. Their line, of course, was in 4 years vote for Labour and we will repeal the tax. So this was a massive mass movement breaking the law. It was started by anarchists, and much with the Occupy Wall Street movement, hence the forms that it took and the way we organized were kind of directed by us anarchists, meaning we organized locally, we organized those local groups into federations, those federations federated regionally and then nationally and then all throughout the UK. So there's that kind of classic anarchist horizontal delegate-based form of organizing. When we come to the tricky part of vanguards, so I would argue that if a vanguard is the definition of vanguard as being ahead of the curve, then us anarchists were undoubtedly a vanguard. The problem that we had was we were, in defeating the poll tax, we were entirely successful. Why I say we failed, and it was a horrible Pyrrhic victory, was after 6 years of struggle, we were victorious but completely exhausted. And we singularly failed to extend the anti-poll tax campaign beyond that particular single issue. As anarchists, we saw this as, not as a stepping stone, but as part of that wider struggle, which we wanted to extend both in narrow and in broad ways. In narrow ways, our logic was if we can defeat local government, if we can defeat the state government, national government, why can't we do it about other things? If we can stop the sheriffs coming round and seizing people's luxury goods, which is what they were supposed to do if you didn't pay the poll tax, why can't we stop them evicting people who can't afford to pay their rent? Why can't we stop them turning off people's electricity? And so we singularly failed to kind of broaden the successes and the logic of that movement. Finally, in terms of the kind of vanguard question and our politics, deliberately did not push our politics. The anti-poll tax organising was based on, A, of course, opposition to this unfair, unjust economic tax, and secondly, we organised locally, as in it was a community, as in neighbourhood form of organising. And we deliberately played down our politics. We didn't hide them, but we didn't say, hey, we're opposed to this tax because we're anarchists and we have this analysis of society, and we're organising in these very successful ways because we're anarchists. As such, the campaign was completely bereft and denuded of politics. And I think that's part of the reason that we failed to take it any further, shall we say.
I'm speaking with Ramsey Kanan, a publisher at PM Press and an anarchist for much of his life. I see a sharp contrast between what you just described and the Occupy movements at the present. The anti-poll tax movement was about something very specific. This tax stinks and don't pay it. And against the vague and sprawling sentiments, I'm not sure I could call them demands even, of the Occupy Wall Street and its spinoffs. What about those two different things? What are there any lessons from the poll tax for this far more broad and sprawling movement?
I think there are a variety of lessons I would like to see applied. I think one of them actually has been applied. The success of the anti-poll tax movement was because we were organized. I think one of the problems of the left in America and to a large extent, of course, of the left in Europe, is that there's this horrible amnesia that everything is presumed to have just kind of appeared out of the ether, or, you know, everything happens in a vacuum. That's patently not the case. One of the successes, I think, of the anti-poll tax movement was that we were in the right place at the right time. Sure, we had the right ideas and whatnot, but those ideas and being in the right place came out of, you know, 5 to 10 years of prior organizing in Edinburgh. The same is true, I think, of the Occupy Wall Street movement, and that insofar as much of its ideas and practices have come from anarchists, which I think is undoubtedly the case, those self-same North American anarchists have been kind of honing their ideas and their practices over the last 20 years. Some of those ideas and practice I may disagree with, or some of the tactics and strategies, but nevertheless, they've come in many ways out of the organizing which culminated in the very successful shutting down of Seattle. And again, those ideas and those practices came out of this kind of long tradition of anarchist organizing.
Now, you said you had some reservations about the current movement. What would those be?
Well, I think a lot of the debates going on now are being framed in strange ways, in that I think one of the strengths and perhaps one of the weaknesses of anarchism is that not only has anarchism been this broad church of ideas, but anarchism is an ever-evolving set of theories and practices. It's not a, you know, it's not the tablets written in stone which are then to be interpreted correctly and put into practice. It is a much more fluid set of theories and practices which evolve as they go along. Anarchists have been happy, which again I think is strength when they're applied well, and is a weakness when they're not, to kind of liberally lift or generously lift ideas from all sorts of places. So in terms of the kind of current practices that we're seeing at the moment in the Occupy Wall Street movement, these are both in terms of the General Assemblies and consensus politics are particular applications of ideas put into practice by anarchists. Similarly, the much more controversial black bloc tactics, shall we say, and some of the so-called violence that's been going on, again, is an application of recent anarchists taking ideas and practices and attempting to replicate themselves over here. To take the two one after the other, has been fairly widely discussed now, the General Assemblies and the use of consensus is not an anarchist invention, certainly come out of partly out of the Quaker tradition here in America, the consensus decision-making and twinkling and such like, and they also come out of the direct action movements of the 80s, particularly the anti-nuclear stuff, Clamshell Alliance in the Northeast, and then here in the Bay Area, the Livermore Action Group and such like. Now, again, many of those practitioners evolved those tactics, were anarchists, and much of those tactics and strategy were also used to shut down Seattle 15 years later. What is forgotten, or what hasn't been applied, shall we say, which I think is unfortunate, is that the consensus decision-making was only one strand of that particular set of kind of theories and practices. The other strand, of which there's a long venerable anarchist tradition, going back at least 100 years more or more, is that anarchist tradition of the affinity group. So one of the successes was that not only were decisions taken in kind of spokes councils and on with consensus, but those spokes councils, as they suggest, were councils of affinity groups, that people were actually asked to organize with your close friends, comrades, and trusted people, and it was that organization of affinity groups which would come together democratically agree with consensus in a spokes council on what to do and then do it. I say the affinity group has a long glorious anarchist tradition, and one of its advantages in the current climate is, of course, is that if you're working only with people that you know and trust, there's a lot less ability for the state or other provocateurs to actually get involved with actions. The other kind of hot topic, I guess, about anarchist tactics and strategy, which the kind of Occupy movement has brought to light, is that of the Black Bloc, which again, of course, was a component of many of the actions against the IMF and World Bank over the previous decade. The Black Bloc is a tactic and strategy which the anarchists borrowed from the European autonomous folks. Again, I say borrowed because the European autonomists are by and large not anarchists. They've never identified as anarchists. And in many ways, I would argue, this is perhaps a different topic, they exemplify all the problems of organizing without a class analysis. They are very much kind of anti-imperialists in their forms of organizing and kind of single issues. The autonomous people will perhaps remember were involved very much in Europe in the 1980s, and this is not in the UK, but in continental mainland Europe, most notably in Germany, but also in Italy, in Holland and France. They were involved in the wave of squatting, very much involved in anti-fascist activities and very spectacularly in anti-nuclear activities in the 80s. The so-called Black Bloc, because they all dressed in black, so to be anonymous, so again, it's more difficult to be picked up by the police. And they were very well organized, almost kind of paramilitary, in that they acted in concert together to be much more effective. They were very combative, both against fascists and against the police. So in the 80s, there was an attempt to bring that, largely dismally, bring that kind of form of that tactic, that way of organizing on, shall we say, militant demonstrations and actions, that was transposed to North America. It had many spectacular, dismal failures, very embarrassing, one of which I witnessed in 1989 here in the Bay Area, when there was a march demonstration called as part of the Continental Anarchist Gathering, which was an incredibly badly, childishly executed form of direct action, where a few people, you know, decided to mask up and dress in black, as they'd seen their European comrades do very successfully. They randomly attacked a Coca-Cola truck, broke some windows of a church housing homeless people, and then were, of course, promptly rounded up by the police because they all tried to go home on BART, and the police just waited at the BART station and arrested everyone dressed in black. But nevertheless, that was an early example of kind of anarchists attempting to use what were successful European tactics in this kind of North American context, and we've seen that used to a greater or lesser effect over the last 20 years, and again, very controversially, certainly at the Oakland so-called general strike last Wednesday.
Let me conclude on a rather blunt note. I think an awful lot of people who are, you know, the Occupy movement has attracted a lot of sympathy among a broad population that has not been particularly political necessarily. They basically just want rich folks to help pay for better schools, better trains, cleaner air, maybe create some jobs. But you know, they wouldn't go all the way with anarchism. And I think if they were pressed, they would say, do you really believe that a complex society could exist without a state? Do you really believe a complex society could exist without a state?
Yes. I think history has shown that actually hugely complex societies exist despite the state, not because of the state. People organize in all kinds of complex ways and get things done. And in fact, we've seen in revolutionary situations, those same complex societies organize themselves much better without the dead hand of the state. Again, I say the most kind of thoroughgoing and best example of this would be in the Spanish Revolution, where both in terms of the industry of Barcelona in particular and Catalonia in general, and also in terms of agricultural production, the anarchist collectives and communes and trade unions, again, the CNT, the anarchist trade union, numbered 3 million in Spain in 1936, so again, a vast, complex, numerous society. Actually, you know, the anarchists during the Spanish Revolution actually made the trains run on time, and also increased agricultural production, despite the fact that they were in a war and in a revolutionary situation. So yes, I think incredibly complex societies have been able to organize successfully on more egalitarian, horizontal, and non-status forms. I think having the wherewithal to organize that is always the kind of key question. Again, the success of the Spanish Revolution, insofar as it was successful, came because of 40 years of anarchist organizing. It didn't just appear out of nowhere, and people didn't suddenly say, aha, the state is in disarray, I will organize myself much more productively. There's a lot more to it than that. I think one of the interesting things about the Occupy Wall Street movement, though, is that it has, perhaps for the first time since I've lived here for the last 20 years, put class politics and class analysis somewhat back on the agenda, which I think is all for the better.
I was Ramsey Kanan, punk rocker, publisher, and anarchist. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Speaking of class war, let's go out with this, Mission of Burma's cover of the Dills' Class War. Till next week, bye.